All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW-2 helicopter pilot, Vietnam 1969. I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio today. We've got, I think, is a great program. We're going to be talking with a gentleman initially about a project out in Kansas City that's building tiny houses for veterans. And then I want to make sure that you stay tuned for the second half of the program, because we're going to be doing a little history project today. We're going to be talking with Brian Vandermark, who is the author of a book entitled Road to Disaster, A New History of America's Descent into Vietnam. And I found it to be a really compelling book, and I think there's going to be some information that most of you, and I certainly didn't know about the Vietnam conflict and about some other things that were going on in the 60s, because, you know, we were all pretty self-absorbed ourselves back in the day, as they say. But he's going to be talking to us, hopefully, about the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, and eventually we get up into the Nixon, and see if there are some lessons that may be learned that are coming forward today as we look at what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also just the idea of politicians coming into power and not really having a whole lot of experience, and they have a tendency to follow whatever went before them. And I think that's going to be part of the main message. So I'm really excited to talk with Brian about that. But first of all, right now joining me on the line is a gentleman. His name is Brandon Mixon, and he is from the Veterans Community Project. And let me just give you a little background on Brandon. He spent 4 years with the 82nd Airborne, during which he deployed to Afghanistan in September of 2011, participating in Operation Enduring Freedom. He medically retired from the Army in 2013, returned home to the big town of Lee's Summit, Missouri. He started and was the CEO of Airborne Mechanical, providing veterans with low-cost free heating and cooling services. A great project right there. And he left his business entirely to co-found Veterans Community Project. So, Brandon, I want to bring you on right now and welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again for having me on today. Really excited to tell everybody about the project. And, thanks again for having me on.
Well, yeah, because it's a great project. I was really interested in this whole thing of providing housing for veterans. And so could you tell us a little bit about what the Veterans Community Project is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Veterans Community Project is a nonprofit that provides transitional housing for homeless veterans in Kansas City, Missouri. Not only that, but also provides the wraparound services. So the health care, the dental care, the veterinary services. We're trying to be a one-stop shop for all veterans.
Mm-hmm.
What's unique about that is what our definition of a veteran is. Our definition of a veteran is anybody who served. So we don't care if you served a day in the military, 30 years in the military, reservist, or National Guard. At the end of the day, you're my brother, you're my sister, I'm going to do whatever it takes to save your life. And how it actually got started was we were just mutually frustrated with other nonprofits, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other nonprofits are government funded. So a lot of them aren't able to help, you know, reservists or National Guard or disarmed, discharged guys. And literally, myself and three of my other buddies kind of came together with the mutual frustration and wanted to do more for our brothers and sisters.
Okay. Well, the thing that's really interesting about your project is that you're building tiny houses for everyone.
Yes, absolutely. So what's cool about that is we do it inside city limits, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not the very first ones that come up with the tiny house concept or anything else like that. But we are the very first ones to build them according to code and put them inside city limits in that aspect, right? The reason why it's so important to put them inside city limits is, where's your homeless? Where's your resources? Where's your transportation?
Right. That's where the veterans are.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same thing with the tiny house concept. The reason why we went with the tiny house concept was not because it was cool or cheap or anything else like that. It's actually a little bit more expensive, but tiny houses help us with transition. So a lot of us vets getting out of the military, and you could probably speak about it as well, struggle with the transition getting out of the military, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we wanted to do was give them something similar to a barracks lifestyle or B-Huts, et cetera, or clinics as though we lived in Afghanistan or Iraq. We wanted to put them back in that military mentality and kind of flip the switch, right? And okay. also give them the daily amenities you'd see in your normal housing, like a bathroom, a shower, a kitchen, and then like, kind of the whole nine. And what it's doing is it's literally flipping a switch with these guys and saying, hey, okay, I'm getting back into this military mentality, and then us helping them through that transition of the military mentality back into a civilian life mentality.
So you've got to, I forget the number of houses that you've built already. I saw a picture on your website. It kind of looks like Plasticville, but it's really kind of cool. So the veteran gets a house to stay in. How long can they stay there?
So what's very unique about us, since we're privately funded, I don't take any type of government funding, the actual program is determined around the individual's needs. So if an individual comes in and says, hey, I'm struggling with the health issues, we get them. The health issues, if you're struggling with maybe money management issues, we can help them with that, right? Mm-hmm. And so the length of time is determined with the clinical director, the case manager, and the actual individual veteran. You know, it's not proper to say that just because you have a certain issue, you're only allowed to stay a certain amount of time, like a lot of other programs. As long as we're showing progression in our program and, going kind of through those steps they need to go through, they're allowed to stay, right? We mm-hmm. haven't had anybody stay longer than a year. A lot of these guys actually want to get out and then help their other brothers and sisters. So the length of time is actually determined on an individual basis, if that makes sense. Sorry, I'm not trying to beat around the bush. It's hard to explain the scenario, you know?
No, that's fine. I mean, we're talking with Brandon Mick, one of the founders of the Veterans Community Project. This one happens to be in Kansas City, Missouri. And the reason that I was so interested in this is that in addition to the housing, you also provide them other sorts of care and medical care and transitional training and helping with getting their benefits and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Two of the other founders worked for nonprofits before. We did a lot of research. We were really frustrated and struggling because we couldn't find any nonprofits that, again, provided the wraparound services.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did provide wraparound services, they had to be honorably discharged and meet certain requirements, you know, and that's in a way not fair. Again, why is it my same brother and sister would have had my back in Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, but yet here I'm safe in the United States and literally my brothers and sisters are on the street, you know, dying, literally, you know, nobody's dragging them to safety and saving their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thought process that we have at Veterans Community Project. So again, if they need resume writing classes, we provide that, right? So it didn't come out of our funding. We actually have community partners to provide that. Like Harvesters is one of our great partners. Community America. We have a lot of different partners that are able to provide those resources, right? So again, we can provide those wraparound services. Again, on site, we provide healthcare, dental care, veterinary services, a barbershop, resume writing classes. We have free legal services. Also, we also, created a program here in Kansas City. It's one of the very first of its kind. We also provide free transportation for all veterans. And what we did was we actually partnered with the city of Kansas City. And so they actually come into us. They bring a DD Form 214 or some type of veteran verification, and they're able to actually get a bus pass. So what they do is they slide it, and it's actually good for 3 years. So that's why it's, you know, it's very important to the success. I mean, it's something mm-hmm. as simple as $1.35 bus pass is very major to the success of a lot of our veterans. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of our flagship program. And our goal is not to take that just here in Kansas City, but actually nationwide. Well, that's very important, again, to the success of these veterans.
Well, I think it certainly appears like you're doing a great job out there, Brandon. And this is a Veterans Community Project. And you want to find out more information, folks, you go to their website. It's veteranscommunityproject.org. And it sounds like something that could be done in a lot of these major cities. I know when first time I saw this, I was thinking, wow, Detroit could really benefit by this because first of all, we have a lot of veterans in the area. Second of all, we have a lot of vacant land because they're trying to rebuild the city and they're trying to figure out what to put in these old demolished houses. And this sounds like something that they could do really easily.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, our goal is like, I don't know if I already said earlier in the broadcast, I apologize. Over 627 cities have reached out to us. Mm-hmm. We've been very fortunate enough now to be Time Magazine seen in a lot of these different places. With that being said, there's a huge need for expansion, right?
Yeah.
We're kind of paving the pathway for this to be done. We're currently working in Colorado right now, Illinois right now, Texas, and Tennessee. So you guys will start seeing this popping up here soon. But again, It's just about the community. The community getting involved and making an impact and a difference. We're not doing this by ourselves. It's literally been, you know, community partners and people just like yourselves that are like, you know what? I'm going to make a difference and impact and help. So,
right. I totally agree. Is there a phone number people could use to call you?
You know what? The best thing to do is actually hop on our website.
Okay.
VeteransCommunityProject.org. And actually check out our website. There's a volunteer tab. If you guys want to come down and build houses, you're able to do that. So on our property, and I apologize that I didn't cover this, we have 49 houses is what we're going to be putting. Right now we have 13 and building an additional 13. So we're going to be building 13 more houses till November 8th. If anybody gets a chance, we'd love to have volunteers up here to help us build these houses. Same thing, if anybody would like to have a tour, like come down and visit Kansas City, please do.
Mm-hmm.
But again, our website is veteranscommunityproject.org. There's a lot of information on there. There's an info email on there. Again, I'd love to talk with every single one of you guys.
It looks like it
makes a difference.
As I said, again, this is a great project, and I encourage people, especially out in the Missouri-Kansas area, you know, here's a nice weekend tour. You can go up there and build a house.
It's
going to help veterans out. So thank you very much, Brandon Mixon from Veterans Community Project. The website, again, is veterancommunityproject.org. You can find them on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram, it looks like, everywhere else. Their website, you can just click on contact and find out more. Thanks very much, Brandon, for being on our program.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again. And I look forward to getting more great information from the program.
Okie doke. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, folks, this is a really great program they've got going on out there in Kansas City, and I'm just, you know, we all talk here in the Southeast Michigan area about what we can do to help our veterans, and we've got so many great nonprofit organizations around here already, and I know that they're trying to build a veterans facility in somewhere around here, I know that, in Southeastern Michigan, but wouldn't this be great if we could go down to Detroit, put a whole bunch of whole little tiny houses up there and have every facility that they need? Sounds like a good idea. So go to Veterans Community Project if it's something that is of interest to you. All right, we're going to take a quick break after a little to pay for our program here. I got to remind you that our program is brought to you by Legal Help for Veterans and the other veteran disability claims experts, and that's all they do. So you can give Legal Help for Veterans a call today at 800-693-4800. The other sponsor today is going to be the Graft O'Hara VFW Post 423 here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They're down on South Wagner Road. They're the ones that are going to be bringing us our Medal of Honor today, and we want to thank Graft O'Hara VFW Post 423 for helping keep Veterans Radio going. So we're going to take this quick break, and we'll be right back with our guest, and that is Brian Vandermark, and his book is Road to Disaster. And stay tuned. You got to hear this guy. It's going to be a good story. We'll be right back after this.
Our government is united in its determination to take all necessary measures in support of freedom and in defense of peace in Southeast Asia.
Got a letter from LBJ. It said, this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very queer, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and I get to be the host today. This is Dale Thromery talking to you right now. And welcoming to Veterans Radio is the author of a new book that's just coming out, is Road to Disaster. His name is Brian Vandermark, and Brian, too many letters there. And Brian teaches history at the United States Naval Academy, where for more than 25 years he has taught midshipmen about the Vietnam War. He's also been a visiting fellow at Oxford University. He was a research assistant on Clark Clifford's best-selling autobiography, Counsel to the President, and a co-author of Robert McNamara's number one bestseller In Retrospect. He's also the author of Into the Quagmire, which came out as his PhD dissertation on LBJ and the war, and currently lives in Maryland. And Brian, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Glad to join you, Dale. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. I really was excited when I got this book. Your PR person, Andy, sent me a proof copy, which I think is really cool. But, you know, I, being a participant in the Vietnam War, it just opened a whole new windows of understanding to me when we are talking about the characters that are involved in this. So I'm going to give you a chance to talk about, you're coming at this from a totally different direction. Could you kind of explain to our audience what that means?
Yes. It's a combination of reflection based on personal experience with very senior level decision makers in the Johnson administration during the war, and equally importantly, the insights and findings of social scientific research that speak to the flaws and limitations of cognitive ability, even on the part of highly intelligent people, in terms of how they process information, fail to question their assumptions, things of that nature. And I think it helps explain a fundamental riddle related to the war, which is, how could a group oftentimes referred to as the best and the brightest, who had so high IQs, such great intelligence, how could they make such poor decisions, bad misjudgments, leading to the death and suffering of so many people, given the fact that they were not only smart but decent people? And the fundamental question is, how do good people make bad decisions? How does that happen?
All right. I want our audience to kind of pay attention, because we're going to get a little history lesson here, but it's kind of a history in reverse. We're trying to look inside the brains of these men and, you know, that made these decisions. And you started off, right? What grabbed me right off in the book was your description of what occurred during the Bay of Pigs invasion, or the attempted invasion of Cuba. Could you talk about that briefly?
Yes. I spent the first several pages of the book addressing events that occurred during the Kennedy administration before I turned to the topic of Vietnam, because in many respects, a lot of the dynamics that were created during the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis will be carried over to the Vietnam decision-making. For example, the very tense relationship between President Kennedy and the senior military services representatives, that created a sense of tension and mistrust on the part of President Kennedy and later President Johnson toward the advice of the senior military, which would have a huge impact when it came to Vietnam decision-making. And that was also true during the Cuban Missile Crisis. For example, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Curtis LeMay, and the Chief of Naval Operations for the Navy, George Anderson, both pressed Kennedy very hard to attack Cuba during the Missile Crisis, and Kennedy was seeking to avoid a showdown in the nuclear war with the Soviets. And I think that that led him and McNamara and other of his civilian advisors to question the judgment of military officers. And I think that had a tremendous impact on the ability of both civilian leaders and military leaders to really let their hair down with each other and share their frustrations and fears in a candid way during the Vietnam War. And that was not good when it came to making wise policy decisions.
Right. You mentioned when you were talking about the Bay of Pigs, this is something that Kennedy actually inherited from the Eisenhower administration, and he could have stopped it at any time.
Yes. Remember, Dale, that he was a celebrity politician who had a lot of charisma. He was very articulate and very intelligent and handsome, but he didn't have a lot of experience when it came to the way that the executive branch of the government worked. And he was only 44 years old when he became president of the United States in January of 1961. And he inherited a plan by the CIA that had been initiated under the Eisenhower administration to land a force of 1,500 Cuban exiles in the belief that they would be able to liberate an island from Castro's regime, in which his army had 130 times as many soldiers.
Right.
And keep the whole thing secret. And in hindsight, it just looks preposterous that those kinds of assumptions would have been bought into by Kennedy and his advisors, but they were inexperienced. I think that inexperience combined with the human tendency toward wishful thinking led them to not question their assumptions, and that produced some serious misjudgments. And that kind of process repeated itself during the Vietnam War.
Right. It certainly did. And the Bay of Pigs was a disaster. So then the Cuban Missile Crisis came right on the heels of that. And actually, I thought that based on what I was reading in your book, we're talking with Brian Vandermark here. His book is called Road to Disaster, New History of America's Descent into Vietnam. And we're watching Kennedy, especially Kennedy, I think, go through the learning process of how to make these decisions when you've got all these other influences around you. and that, you know, and plus he's dealing with, you know, Khrushchev, and the only thing that most of us remember about Khrushchev was, you know, banging his shoe on a table at the UN. And
right.
So what do you think was the, what do you think that he learned and, or didn't learn from the missile crisis?
Well, I think he drew several lessons from the missile crisis that, in the context of the decision-making on Vietnam that followed shortly thereafter were very unfortunate. I think one of them was he and his advisors, like McNamara and Rusk and Bundy, developed this illusory belief that they controlled events to a degree that they simply did not. They couldn't know that the successful resolution of the missile crisis without a showdown militarily between the United States and the Soviet Union was, to a significant degree, a function of just plain dumb luck. But instead, they saw it as a huge success in terms of deliberation on war and peace, and they thought that they, as smart people, controlled events. And I think they transferred that assumption onto their Vietnam decision-making, and that proved to be a catastrophic misjudgment. I think the other factor is that their belief in the judgment of senior military officers had been shaken during the missile crisis.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, LeMay and Anderson pressed Kennedy hard to attack Cuba, even though they suspected that that would probably lead to a showdown with the Soviets, and that's exactly what Kennedy was trying to avoid. And I think his skepticism about the judgment of the senior military also would carry over to Vietnam decision-making, because the same advisors to Kennedy were those who advised Johnson.
It's a complicated issue, that's for sure. When you were talking about, you know, one of the things that you mentioned in the book that, that really got my attention was the idea that we didn't know who our enemy was, especially in Vietnam. We didn't know who our enemy really was. We thought it was the Chinese. We thought it was the Russians. We thought it was Ho Chi Minh. We didn't know.
Well, I think that that entire generation of Americans, not just Kennedy and Johnson and their advisors, but the vast majority of Americans of that generation were far more familiar with European history and American history than they were with East Asian history.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, you can look back and fault them for their ignorance and the consequences of their ignorance. But in a sense, you have to fault the entire generation of Americans as well, because I don't think that they were unusual in that respect. And that's true not only of civilian decision makers, but the military as well. I go into great detail about Westmoreland and why he chose the attrition strategy to apply in that war. Mm-hmm. Again, hindsight's 20/20, but it was a deeply unwise choice of strategy, because the opponents that we faced there, in one instance during the Battle of the Drang Valley in November of 1965, they fought war on our terms. Mm-hmm. Which was to fight it conventionally in an open field in which our superior mobility and firepower devastated them.
Right.
But they learned from that. And after that, they got smart. They stopped fighting war on our terms and started fighting it on their terms, which was not to give us battle, not to fight the war conventionally, but instead to revert to asymmetrical guerrilla warfare, hit-and-run attacks, booby traps, skirmishes on a very small scale. And what that allowed them to do was to control their casualties.
Mm-hmm.
By controlling their casualties, they negated the fundamental premise of the attrition strategy.
Well, again, we are looking at this, or you're looking at this, more from not just historical perspective, but why these people made these particular decisions. And many of them were made because they hadn't paid attention, I guess, to their history. After World War II, you mentioned that we came out of World War II being the big giant gorilla in the room. And
yes,
and then we, for some reason, we gave Vietnam back to the French, and that kind of started that proverbial slippery slope.
Right. Well, remember, Dale, that at the time that the United States began helping the French after World War II, the whole region of Indochina seemed to be of marginal importance to Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Truman was sent a letter by Ho Chi Minh begging him to support Vietnamese independence from the French. He never got the letter. That's not because they were trying to torpedo Ho Chi Minh. It's just that a letter from an obscure guerrilla leader in Indochina would never have made it to the top of the bureaucratic process in 1945. And it's indicative of our priorities. In other words, it's Europe and our relationship with Western Europe and NATO and our fear of Soviet expansion to Western Europe that preoccupied decision makers during that period. And they had certain assumptions about the monolithic nature of communism and the domino theory that whatever validity they had early on during the Cold War, by the early 1960s, had become dangerously outdated in many respects, and yet they kept applying those assumptions uncritically, without really questioning them and asking themselves, is it still relevant, or have circumstances changed in a way that make them much less relevant?
Okay, and we are coming up on a break, and when we get back from the break, I want to talk about, obviously, how we got involved in Vietnam and what some of the lessons are that hopefully that we have learned in the future. We are talking with Brian Vandermark. He's the author of a new book entitled Road to Disaster, New History of America's Descent into Vietnam. And it just, you got to listen to this. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. And we will be back right after the news, so don't go away.
Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with our guest, Brian Vandermark. He's the author of a book entitled Road to Disaster, A New History of America's Descent into Vietnam. And we just, before we took a break for the news, we were talking about some of the mistakes that were made and some of the lessons that were learned, we hope, during the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And now we've gotten up to the point now where, I guess it's just before Kennedy was assassinated. How did Kennedy get himself involved in Vietnam?
Well, he had visited Vietnam in the early 1950s when he had been a junior senator from Massachusetts and had seen the dynamics at work between the local Vietnamese and the French who had returned to rule that region of the world. And I think that part of him recognized that there was a deeply political dimension to the conflict. But there was also the politician in Kennedy. And remember, too, he was a Democratic politician who had vividly remembered, because he had witnessed and frankly participated in the criticism of Truman for, quote, losing, unquote, China to the communists in 1949. I think he and Johnson, being Democratic presidents, deeply feared the political consequences of walking away from South Vietnam. And because of that, they didn't really trust their deeper instincts, which was this thing is a loser, because the foundation on which we're trying to build our effort was one of quicksand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, because the Democrats, I guess you can say traditionally, have been labeled as the ones that don't want to be involved in a war, and they're always trying to figure out ways to get out of it, and the other side doesn't necessarily agree with that, and I think that has to do with ego and some other things that come into play with that as well. But
I think, too, Johnson in particular, after Kennedy's assassination, was determined to pass civil and voting rights legislation granting equality to African Americans for the first time in American history. And I think that was a passionate commitment of his, and I think a significant part of him feared that Republican opposition and the Southern Democratic opposition to voting rights and civil rights for African Americans would be expressed through attacks on him if he didn't hold the line in Vietnam. Now, I think some of what he was doing in Vietnam is a function of his ego, his pride, his insecurities, his deep unwillingness to become the first president to lose a war, and, as I point out in the book, the tendency on the part of all of us to become victim to what's known as the sunk cost fallacy. In other words, once you and I have committed ourselves to a particular course of action and invested in that course, the human tendency is to double down on your bet to avoid losing the hand. And I think for presidents in particular, that's an especially powerful dynamic because they have made decisions that have led to the loss of American lives. And the last thing they want to do is to walk away from that commitment because that means they run the risk of invalidating the sacrifice of those lives.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, their tendency, therefore, is to double down. And I think Johnson did that again and again and again until probably by the end of 67, the beginning of 68, he began to realize that it was a bottomless pit, that doubling down was simply intensifying the level of American casualties without really turning a corner in the conflict against the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. It's very difficult psychologically, I think, for presidents to admit to themselves that they've made a grievous error,
mm-hmm.
not only for their own reputation, but because of all the lives that have been lost because of their misjudgments.
Could you go into a little bit of detail about how we, while we were in Vietnam, we went from, you know, 20,000 to 50,000 to up to over 500,000 by the mm-hmm. time I was there in 1969. How did that, those decisions, how were those made?
Well, I think you've all heard that expression, the slippery slope. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. Once you start down that slope, your ability to stop once you're on that slope is almost impossible. Kennedy, for example, when he became president, there were fewer than 1,000 American military advisors in South Vietnam. He was pressured by the military to send combat troops. He refused to do that because he didn't think that that was the solution. But in return, he felt that he had to compensate for that refusal by agreeing to sending more and more military advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he was assassinated, there were 16,000 American military advisors in South Vietnam, and that in itself created a lot of momentum.
Sure.
And it's indicative of this tendency, I think, on the part of decision-making in general and decision-making on wars specifically, that the law of unexpected and unanticipated consequences rules in a war.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Johnson, for example, when he committed the first combat troops in the spring of 1965, ever in his worst nightmare, thought it would reach 500,000 within less than 3 years. And yet he would make those decisions, partly because of momentum, partly because the military was pressuring him relentlessly to do so, partly it's this loss aversion, where he feels, I cannot walk away because I've already made decisions that led to the loss of American lives.
Mm-hmm.
And to walk away would be to invalidate the sacrifice. So you can see how he would be compelled to continue doubling down on a flawed policy.
Oof, wow. you mentioned in the book that you were talking about that we really didn't know. You know, we had this fear of the domino theory, as you know, that if Vietnam fell, then Laos would fall and Cambodia would fall and so forth to the Chinese.
Yes.
But we also, we didn't really understand the definition of communism or the different levels of communism, I guess, between Russia and the Chinese.
Well, I think we talked a little earlier about this perception during the Cold War of the monolithic nature of communism.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a fair amount of truth to that early on in the late 40s and early 50s when the Soviet Union and China did have a military alliance. But by the late 50s and early 60s, that relationship was seriously on the rocks. And yet our operating assumption was still trapped in that earlier mindset. For example, a lot of Kennedy and Johnson's advisors believe that the Chinese were putting up the North Vietnamese to aggression in South mm-hmm. Vietnam. Of course, the reality was that the last thing the North Vietnamese want are the Chinese in their country, because the Vietnamese for hundreds of years had fought dozens of wars against the Chinese. And yet, unless you understand Vietnamese history and the very long roots of Vietnamese suspicion and fear of the Chinese, you would never have grasped that point. Now, would the North Vietnamese have been willing to accept Chinese troops in North Vietnam in the event of an American invasion? Yes. Mm-hmm. But that is a very different proposition from the perception or the belief that it was the Chinese who were driving the North Vietnamese toward their aggression in the South.
I think it's really interesting, and most of us, you know, most Vietnam veterans understand that it was a war for independence really going on inside of Vietnam while we were there. It was the North against the South, and we were on the South side, and that the Republic of Vietnam was not the most stable government throughout the whole time we were there.
Well, you're right, Dale. And I mean, the tragedy is that we sincerely and with good purposes and principles tried to build a democratic small D political culture in South Vietnam. But we were working against history and momentum. In this case, most of the fighting against the Japanese during World War II and certainly against the French during the French Indochina War in the late 40s and early 50s had been led by the Viet Minh, who were the communists.
Mm-hmm.
They had earned street credibility with ordinary Vietnamese peasants because they had bled and fought for an occupation, whereas the leader of South Vietnam that we installed and tried to prop up, Ngo Dinh Diem, had spent that same period, the late 40s and early 50s, in the United States at Catholic monasteries and networking political leaders in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to disparage him, but you can see that the disadvantage that we were operating from the beginning, because the leader of South Vietnam, Diem, was a Catholic in a country in which 85% of the Vietnamese were Buddhists.
Right.
And again, hindsight's 2020, and you can see all the profound limitations and vulnerabilities that exist on the part of our South Vietnamese ally. And I think that what's tragic is that we didn't know Vietnamese history well enough to understand and accept the fact that in that case, the authentic nationalists who had earned street credibility with ordinary Vietnamese were tragically and unfortunately our adversaries in that war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading that in the book, and we're talking is again with Brian Vandermark. His book is Road to Disaster. It's just a very disturbing story of how we ended up, you know, being involved in Vietnam and how you know, Lyndon Johnson was trying to. It was like a juggler almost. He was trying to juggle his civil rights movement. He's trying to juggle everything else that was going on in the world, and we never actually give him credit for what he was able to accomplish even during this time of such turmoil.
Well, I think it's important, Dale, to recognize that old expression, where you stand depends on where you sit, has a lot of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
Westmoreland, for example, followed by Abrams, being military commanders in Vietnam, their field of vision, their responsibility was the theater of operations in Southeast Asia itself. The recommendations that they would make to Johnson were based on their responsibilities, which were theater-wide.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson, on the other hand, is weighing the effect of that kind of decision-making on our relationships globally. For example, he over and over again resisted the argument that we should invade North Vietnam. And the reason he did that was the CIA and the State Department advised him that an American invasion of North Vietnam would trigger a Chinese intervention in North Vietnam as it happened during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know it at the time, but the reality is we've learned since then that that was correct, that there was an agreement between North Vietnam and China, that if the Americans had invaded North Vietnam, the Chinese would have intervened in the war. As Johnson mm-hmm. pointed out once, we've got hundreds of thousands of American boys there chasing after Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. My God, how many would we have to commit if a million Chinese entered the war?
Yes.
And I think another important thing to recognize is that McNamara and Johnson and Rusk, they meant well. They were patriotic, well-intentioned, intelligent people. And yet that did not protect them from making very, very grievously poor judgments. And I think that that's an important thing for all of us to recognize. And when I teach the subject of Vietnam at the Naval Academy, I tell my students, the midshipmen, that it's not the story of bad people making bad decisions. It's
mm-hmm.
the much more disconcerting story of good people making bad decisions. And the reason I drive that point home to them is they're good people, too.
Right. And
they're the best and brightest of their generation, mm-hmm. which means they are also capable, like all of us, of making misjudgments. It's just that when you make misjudgments at that level, you're affecting the lives of many, many, many people. And I knew McNamara because I worked with him on his memoir.
Mm-hmm.
He came from a generation where he masked his emotions. But privately, mm-hmm. he felt the consequences of his mistakes powerfully. And he had to live with the consequences of those mistakes for four decades before he passed away. And I want veterans of Vietnam to know that the people who sent them into battle tried to do the right thing, made choices that they thought in the context of the time were the right choices. And sometimes bad judgments can result, and yet that does not invalidate the service and sacrifice of those who went to Vietnam, who served, and in some cases never came back.
Right.
McNamara, for example, he never publicly appeared at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. He told me, he said that the pain and shame was simply too great for him. But what he did do, he told me that he would go at night and study those names on the wall so that no one could see him. And he said that that led me to feel a great deal of respect for those who served and whose names were on that wall. And it led me, McNamara, to question those who sent them to serve. That's a very heavy burden.
I would agree. I'm glad that you got into McNamara because, you know, in his final days and years when he was talking about the fog of war and it really, I think that, you know, as you mentioned just now, the guilt that he felt for, you know, putting these men and women in harm's way without really knowing what was going to happen. I think that's something else that you brought out in the book is that, you know, many of these decisions were made for the short term. But nobody really looked at the long-term effects of it. I mean,
no.
They're still going through it even today.
The problem, Dale, is that that dynamic is always present in Washington. Mm-hmm. I suspect that the people who have the responsibility for war and peace decisions in the lives and deaths of American servicemen and women today are operating under the same kind of constraints. They're always dealing with a multiplicity of crises that have to be dealt with now. They're having to make decisions with incomplete information against a rapidly ticking clock, operating oftentimes on assumptions that they haven't re-examined really carefully. And that's a recipe for making bad mistakes. That doesn't mean that they're ill-intentioned mistakes, but the environment of Washington is not one that's conducive to taking the long view. If you're up for election or re-election every 2, 4, 6 years, that too reinforces short-term thinking. And when you preoccupy yourself with short-term thinking, you're not sensitive to the long-term consequences of your decisions and what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that too was a recurrent theme in Vietnam decision-making. They're always dealing with the here and now, the tomorrow, next week, rather than looking down the road. For example, the military came back to Johnson again and again and again for more and more troops. And in hindsight, you can look at that and say it's a bottomless pit. But when you're in the White House and you're facing these kinds of requests, you don't really either have the luxury or the inclination to step outside of yourself and ask yourself, what are the implications of this trend?
Mm-hmm.
For example, Westmoreland told Johnson, in the summer of 1965, when Johnson made the decision to send large numbers of American troops to Vietnam, that he would need a total of 275,000 soldiers. Mm-hmm. By this January of 1968, there are 549,500 American soldiers in Vietnam, and Westmoreland is requesting another 205,000.
I know, I was there. That was when I got grabbed. But I think that you can see it going up and up and up, and it didn't seem like we were making any more headway because, as you pointed out, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were doing this, you know, hide and fight routine, which was frustrating to everyone you know, that was there. And
The United States has a preponderance of superiority in terms of mobility, firepower.
Sure.
We never lost a battle, but that's not the ultimate point. The ultimate point is that our adversary was wise enough not to fight the war on our terms.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that giving Americans battle in the open field would lead to defeat, so they stopped doing it. And when they went asymmetrical and adopted a guerrilla warfare strategy, choosing where, when, and how long to fight, that enabled them to control their casualties, which eliminated the whole rationale of the attrition strategy, and it enabled them to draw out the conflict effectively forever.
Right.
And that was a great vulnerability because they understood that unlike their totalitarian system, in the United States, the political leaders of both parties are deeply sensitive to public opinion. And when the American people lost faith in the war, not because they failed to have sufficient endurance, they just realized that we were pouring more and more resources, men, and treasure into that, and it was simply producing a higher level of stalemate and destruction without turning the corner. the American people eventually said enough is enough. The American national interests at stake there are wildly disproportionate to the sacrifices they're being made, and they washed their hands of it. And I think our adversaries understood that that dynamic was at work, and they played the waiting game. They stayed guerrilla as long as the American military was there, and they waited until after we had left. That's when they went conventional and crushed South Vietnamese in this spring offensive of 1975.
Right, they absolutely did. Tell me a little bit. We've got about 4 minutes to go, Mark. We're talking with Mark Vandermark, who is Brian Vandermark, excuse me. The book is A Road to Disaster, A New History of America's Descent in Vietnam. You've got a great chapter in here about Johnson's decision not to continue, and then he had some difficulty with Humphrey as another presidential candidate. So can you just briefly touch on that?
Yes, I will. I mean, one of the great ironies of this story that's full of ironies is that Johnson was elected president in 1964 by the largest margin in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And yet 4 years later, by 1968, he couldn't be elected dog catcher because of the war. And I think Johnson knew probably by the late fall of 1967 that he was a dead duck politically. He would privately remark, "I cannot unite the people."
Mm-hmm.
And that's a powerfully sobering realization. And I think that by the March of 1968, he understood and was able to read the handwriting on the wall, which is he's not going to be able to get reelected because the American people are too deeply divided over his leadership of the war. And he had the grace to say, "I'm not going to pursue this anymore." Now, that meant that Humphrey, after RFK's death, became the Democratic nominee. And I think there was a part of Johnson, the egotistical, insecure part of Johnson, who deeply resented the notion that there might be a Democratic president who would steal the limelight from him.
Mm.
And in some ways, he was more open and receptive to Nixon's position on the Vietnam War, because Nixon would be a Republican president, which means that Johnson would be the reigning Democratic ex-president. Now, mm-hmm. I think over time, particularly by the late fall of 1968, when it became apparent through wiretaps of various officials that Nixon and his cohort were encouraging the South Vietnamese to stall in terms of opening peace talks in Paris with the North Vietnamese, that enraged Johnson, and he realized that Nixon was playing a double game. But by that point, I think the election was nearing its resolution. And remember, too, that even though the vote between Nixon and Humphrey was very close, the Wallace candidacy,
yes,
which really appealed to hardline opinion, won 12% of the vote. And if you add that up with Nixon's vote, it's hardline opinion rather than Douglas' opinion that was really in the driver's seat by late 1968. You know, people oftentimes accuse Johnson of being a warmonger. I think the reality is he was reluctant to get involved there, didn't know how to get out, was constantly attempting to contain the war so that it wouldn't spin utterly out of control in terms of Chinese intervention. And he always felt the greatest pressures on him were from the right, from people who were pressing him to basically nuke the North Vietnamese rather than the anti-war protesters, which is ironic.
Yeah, it really is. We've got about 2 minutes left, Brian. So what have we learned, do you think?
Well, I think all of us have the same processing vulnerabilities when it comes to how we perceive things, how we process information, how we tend not to question our assumptions, how we tend to double down even on unwise investments for emotional reasons. And social science has proven that even a very high IQ does not protect you from these kinds of cognitive vulnerabilities. I think the other thing for us to try to hold on to is that we learn far more from our failures than we do from our successes. In that sense, if you can go back and look at the tragedy of Vietnam, recognizing that it isn't the story of bad people making bad decisions, it's the deeply uncomfortable story of well-intentioned men making bad decisions, learn from that and tell yourself, I mean well too.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications of that are very sobering. I think it would force people to ask themselves at a fundamental level, what do I really know about a situation? What do I really understand about a situation? What do I really control when it comes to circumstances?
Oh, thank you very, very much, Brian. I appreciate you coming on the program and talking about your book. It's called Road to Disaster, New History of America's Descent into Vietnam. I encourage especially Vietnam veterans to take a look at this book. It's going to open your eyes to a lot of decisions that were made that affected our lives that we weren't even aware of. And I think it also shows, as Brian was pointing out there, that these were decent people who just made mistakes. All right. Thank you very much, Brian, for being on Veterans Radio. The book is available at all the great booksellers, right?
Thank you, Dale. Yes, it is.
All right. Thank you. All right. I've got a real quick announcement to make here. This is kind of a sad thing. Pete Belair, U.S. Marine here in the Ann Arbor area, passed away on Saturday. U.S. Marine, as I mentioned, his services will be on Friday, the 28th of September at noon at the Nye Funeral Home on West Liberty in Ann Arbor. Visitation will be at 11. Our prayers go out to Pete, to his family, to his friends, and to all of his members at VVA 310. Pete, you will definitely be missed. Tune in next week. We're going to be doing our benefits program. You've been listening to Veterans Radio. Until then, you are dismissed.